begin today with a work session on House Bill 2156. Colleagues, you'll recall House Bill 2156 from earlier in the session. This was a bill brought forward by the Department of Human Services, and it deals with the recording of requests for notice in county real property records to allow the estate administration unit the opportunity to monitor these assets and for possible recovery. And we have some dash two amendments, and we've got folks here from the unit. I'll just announce that it's the chair's intention, assuming the committee is willing, to adopt the dash twos and then send this bill down to Ways and Means. Let Representative Winters work with Department of Human Services. They believe that this would actually result in some substantial savings by either disqualifying people who shouldn't qualify based on the status of their assets from services or their ability to recover assets to repay people who have been receiving those services. If I got that right, gentlemen, have I worded it correctly? And it's the dash two amendments that we're looking at. And just for the committee's information, I received an email from Cleve Abbey, who is the Oregon State Council for the title insurance companies. And he advised me that they don't have any problem with the dash two amendments. And I'll quote his email, I do not foresee the bill putting significant new burdens on title companies. So long as DHR is responsive to inquiries about record requests for notice, the bill should not unnecessarily delay real estate transactions. In the past, the estate administration unit has been responsive to title companies. We trust that whichever DHR unit handles the new notices will be equally responsive and that the privacy rules will not hamper inquiries about recorded requests for notice of transfer or encumbrance. So that's the report from the title insurance companies. Gentlemen, I was going to add, I assume you probably aren't ready yet with your fiscal. Am I right about that, or do you have some information?
Chair Williams.
Why don't you put yourself on the record there if you're going to talk to
us? Rick Mills, Department of Human Services.
We did submit a fiscal earlier to LFO, which was about $720,000. Part of the problem with the fiscal is it's very difficult for us to, with scientific accuracy, project what sort of savings we would have on this thing. And sorry, my original inclination was to go with a very conservative number. I believe you should have already gotten that. It was then suggested to us that maybe we could put a range on our fiscal showing kind of a high to a low. When I discussed that with our budget people at Department of Human Services, they were a little bit reluctant to do that for fear that we could end up with a high number on our budget, and if we failed to realize those savings, then we would have some difficulties with our budget at the future date.
Just make you work harder, Rick, that's all.
Well, we have plenty of work. Thank you, Chair Williams.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I want to send you down to Ways and Means, because I think to the extent that this bill gets in front of Senator Winters, where I think it'll go, it will give her the opportunity to work with your budget people on identifying what kind of a savings number you want to apply to this particular bill and allow them to factor that into their budget work that's going down, going on down there. But I think based on the fact that the title, that the land title folks don't seem to have any real problems with the bill, and the fact that it could produce, as you've heard, even a conservative $700,000 potential savings, and I've heard a range that exceeds that by a couple of factors as a possibility.
Yes. So Mr. Ryder from our office, one of our more experienced state administrators, had used some other assumptions, and he thinks that it, that we could probably be looking at somewhere in the region of
what I think it was you came up with?
2.4 for the biennium. As I say, part of our problem is we really don't have precise numbers from which to extrapolate.
Right. And I'm going to let them make the decision down there about how conservative they want to be, and with people above both your and my pay grade to sort of work that detail out. But you know, if the range is really somewhere between $700,000 and $2.4 million for the biennium, it's not chump change. And in a situation where we're as resource strapped as we are, particularly in human resources areas, it seemed appropriate to move this bill down to Senator Winter's committee and let her have the opportunity to try to make those assumptions a little more definite and apply that savings within the system. Is there any discussion or questions for Mr. Mills while we have him here at the dais? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Williams.
Yes, Representative Przanski.
We are in work session. Move the -2s in the House Bill 2156.
Representative Przanski moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2156. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Twos are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2156 as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2156 as amended to the floor with subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion on that motion? Call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Mahomes.
Excuse.
McPherson.
Aye.
Przanski.
Aye.
Federley.
Excused.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2156 is amended, moves to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I would work with your, just a word of advice, because that can be a bit of a black hole down there. Just get whoever's leading your charge down in the Ways and Means Committee to get this on their agenda. And if you need me to send along a letter to Senator Winters, sort of advising her that we've sent her the bill, I'd be pleased to do that. Okay. All right. Now we're going to move into public hearings, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 112, and I'll open a public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Connie Gallagher and Walt Begley are here. Walt's a Marion County District Attorney, Deputy District Attorney. Connie, of course, runs the criminal victims stuff for the Department of Justice. 112 deals with the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention teams, or MDTs. These are the teams that are set up to have a core group that deals with investigating and giving support for child abuse. And these are amendments to the bill, the sections of law that deal with that. I'll let Walt talk about the changes. Specifically, it changes the way that the plans that have to be given. It changes the advisory council a little bit to reflect current practices.
Welcome. You want to start, Connie?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of Crime Victims Assistance Section for the Oregon Department of Justice. This bill updates and clarifies the current law in respect to practice and program changes that have taken place in the field of multidisciplinary child abuse intervention. More specifically, as counsel mentioned, it makes some relatively minor changes, but necessary changes, to what is referred to as the CAMI program. That's the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program. This program was established by statute, several different pieces of legislation between the years 1987 and 1993. It's been instrumental in providing for our state a structure for a coordinated investigation of child abuse, coordination between law enforcement and child protective services in particular, also for requiring specific training of child abuse investigators, thus providing a standard for the training and education of our investigators. And also it provides a structure that supports a community-based approach to child abuse intervention. While it's been a very positive and productive 10 years since this legislation has passed, there's not been any change to the original authorizing legislation. So this year what we'd like to do is just make some relatively minor changes to the statutes, but they're changes which will help the program keep pace with how the program has evolved in the counties since 1993. All of the changes in this bill are agreed upon by all of the stakeholders. I'll very quickly run through the major changes by section. Section 1 modifies the requirements for submitting a child abuse multidisciplinary intervention plan from an annual plan that has been required for the last 10 years to a biannual plan, which seemed to make more sense and creates greater efficiencies for both the county teams as well as our office. However, we do plan to continue to require annual reports from the multidisciplinary teams. Also, Section 1 provides stronger language in regards to reviewing of service outcomes. We wanted to strengthen the emphasis on measurable outcomes and requiring that as part of the annual program reports from the county teams. Section 2 modifies the mandated members of the multidisciplinary child abuse teams. We have deleted courts and we have added juvenile department representation. And again, this reflects a change that's taken place in the counties throughout the state. We have deleted the child care division representatives, since there are very few of them that are currently attending the MDT meetings. And we have added child abuse intervention center workers, since part of this vision back in 1993 was establishing child abuse intervention centers. We're proud to say that we now have 19 operational, and these people need to be recognized as part of the multidisciplinary teams. This does not preclude any team from inviting others if they so wish, but this is the modified list of mandated MDT members. Section 3 amends the current law to clarify duties of the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Advisory Council. It provides for reimbursement to council members for essential expenses incurred in the performance of their duties. It also clarifies that the appointment of these members is by the Attorney General and not by the Director of Human Services, as it had been before the program was transferred to the Department of Justice last session. Sections 4 and 5 modify the current law to clarify that the grant award criteria for community or regional assessment centers is linked to a particular service plan that identifies exactly who will be served and what benefits they will gain from this plan. It also states that any public or private entity may apply to be a community or regional assessment center applicant for these funds. And again, this is more in the nature of a clarification of the practice that has evolved over the last 10 years. Then there are several other minor changes. One you'll see in Section 5, which deletes the words medical examiner and substitutes physician, which is what was intended all along, but there was some confusion over whether we wanted a medical examiner or a treating physician for children. Basically, those are the changes that we're proposing in Senate Bill 112. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Ms. Gallagher? Okay. Is it Walt?
Yeah. Yes, please. Walt Beglaw. Mr. Chair, council members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. I'm the co-chair of our multidisciplinary team for this county as well. Basically, the MDTs act as co-stewards of the dollars that we see flow from the CAMI. In behalf of the MDTs, we lend our support of the changes reflected in Senate Bill 112. I've looked at these. They clarify and simplify the administration and allocation of CAMI dollars to children that receive these benefits by the Department of Justice. And finally, I think they highlight the emerging role that you see throughout the state in child abuse centers and enhances the sound relationship that we already have with the Department of Justice in implementing those programs. So we support this.
Great. All right. Thanks, Walt. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Brzozowski.
Walt, thanks for being here. Did you have a chance to talk to any of the MDT teams around the state? Have you had any feedback?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzozowski, I didn't personally speak with any of the other co-chairs. These were pretty much detail or small housekeeping type amendments, so we did not do that. And I don't think anyone has spoke out that this would in any way not help facilitate the functioning of their team.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Yes, Representative Crummel.
And I don't know if Ms. Gallagher, you or Mr. Bigelow can answer this question, but I see from our summary that there's not been a revenue or fiscal impact statement given with this. And yet in Section 3, there is language in there about compensation for members of the council. I'm just curious as to how we can reimburse people and not have some kind of a fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, the only fiscal associated with this would be those costs for a select number of advisory council members who would be traveling to the advisory council meetings. It's estimated it being less than $500. I don't know whether your question is related to the paperwork process or the cost figure, but that is the cost figure that we submitted.
So whatever, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
So any costs that are associated with the council then can be absorbed into the budget that's already in place. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, there is a certain portion of the CAMI allocation that is set aside for administrative costs. So, yes, this money would be taken from that small portion that's set aside for administrative costs.
Thank you. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 112? Okay, hearing none, I'll close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 112.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruszynski.
Move Senate Bill 112 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Pruszynski moves Senate Bill 112 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay.
Nancy.
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Parker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Sonsky?
Aye.
Beverly?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 112 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier on this one?
Move.
All right. Okay, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 115A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michael Livingston's here for this one. Senate Bill 115A engrossed. Deals with shelter hearings for children that are taken into protective custody. Shelter hearings are the hearings that are held within a short period of time and are the time at which the state must show the reasons why a child's welfare is in jeopardy and that the reason why the child must be taken out of the home. This bill would make it clear that the rules of evidence, meaning hearsay, for example, would not apply to that initial shelter hearing, and they would be governed by whether the evidence would be admissible if it's relevant evidence under the meaning normally associated that with that in the Oregon Evidence Code Rule 401, which is relevant evidence means evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence.
Dr. Livingston, I presume.
not quite. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Michael Livingston with the Appellate Division of the Department of Justice. I think with a little bit of background, the need for this bill will be evident. In Oregon, when a child is placed in protective custody because of concerns of abuse or neglect and cannot be, because of those concerns, returned immediately to the parent, the child is placed in what's called shelter care, and then within 24 hours, the juvenile court must hold a hearing to determine whether that child should remain in shelter care pending the adjudication of a juvenile court petition. Now, because that shelter hearing must be held within 24 hours, the witnesses, for example, police officers, physicians, if they're involved, and often they are unable to attend the hearing or be scheduled for that hearing. And in most of the courts of the state for many years, recognizing that practical necessity, courts have allowed the state to proceed based on reports and other hearsay that would not otherwise be admissible in a civil trial. The statute that governs these hearings, 419B-185, does not specify what types of evidence are admissible in these proceedings. Until recently, this has not been a problem because, as I said, most of, if not all, of the juvenile courts in the state have recognized the necessity of allowing hearsay that's relevant to the issues to the court to come in these cases. But recently, in the last few years, the juvenile courts in Linn County and pro tem judges in one or two other counties have been strictly applying the rules of evidence in these cases to exclude these reports, with the result that children, frankly, are endangered. The state has had to expend more money with additional hearings, and the witnesses, many times doctors and policemen, still can't make these schedules. If I could give an example of a recent case in Linn County. A 14-month-old child was seen in Albany Hospital for what appeared to be a skull fracture. Albany referred the child to Dornbecker in Portland. Dornbecker did diagnose a skull fracture and also a possible fracture to the leg, neither fracture had an explanation that fit the circumstances from the parents. The child was placed in protective custody. A shelter hearing was held within 24 hours. And the court, the Linn County Court, sent the child home with the parents, again, because the treating physicians were not available. All we had were the reports about the doctor's observations and conclusions. Later, after the child had been home and at a time when he was taken again to a hospital for a follow-up examination of that first examination, doctors confirmed the previous suspected injury to the leg, the fracture, and diagnosed a new injury to the other leg. And the nature of both of these leg injuries are such that the doctors were able to conclude that the circumstances were very consistent and highly indicative of abuse. So the child was taken into protective custody a second time based on the new injuries. And again, within 24 hours, a juvenile court hearing was held. At that hearing, the caseworker from DHS testified, and also a local physician who is an expert in child abuse and who had read all of the medical reports related to this child and spoken with the treating physician at Dornbecker. At the close of the hearing, the juvenile court decided that because all this evidence was hearsay and because the physician who testified had not actually been the treating physician, the state had not established its case for continuing shelter care pending adjudication of the petition, and sent this child home again a second time. Now, I should add that this is not the typical case, but I think it certainly it demonstrates what can happen with the strict application of the rules of evidence in these hearings. What Senate Bill 115, A. and Gross, does is to basically prevent that from happening again by recognizing, as recognized by most juvenile courts in the state, the necessity for having this hearsay evidence, and at the same time puts into statute what appears to be, based on our discussions with juvenile court judges from Marion and Clackamas County, district attorneys from various counties, what appears to be the current prevailing standard for the admission of evidence in these proceedings. I'm happy to answer any questions either about the law itself or about the examples which led us to propose this legislation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Livingston. Are there questions for Mr. Livingston? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, what happened to the 14-month-old child the second time?
At the second hearing, the court...
So he was sent home again, but,
yes.
But then were there further...
There are further proceedings pending, and I believe as of today they were finally able to get all of the witnesses there that they needed. I don't know the outcome on the merits, but at least in this case the child appears to have suffered at least one additional injury because of this evidentiary problem.
Okay, thank you. If I may, Mr. Chair. The language is a little bit broad, and I'm a little bit concerned that it is so broad from the standpoint of allowing testimony, reports, and evidence without regard to its admissibility. And how is the court going to then determine that the evidence is relevant to the determinations to come up with the correct determination? I guess I'm concerned that, you know, what it's one thing to have on a legislative record that doctors' reports, admission findings in the hospitals, those sorts of things are admissible into court. But yet to just sort of have the language broad enough, I mean, you could have, Mary Jo from down the street that walks in and says, well, I've heard the baby crying a lot, so I'm pretty sure that baby's being abused. And all of a sudden, you've got parents that their parental rights are being questioned when, in fact, maybe they're really not doing anything improper in terms of how they're raising their child. There's a real balance to how the state intercedes in these situations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, a couple things. First of all, this hearing is not to decide whether the court will have jurisdiction so that it can order the parent or the child to do anything. What this hearing does is decide whether the circumstances of the child are such that the child needs protection before the hearing on the petition can actually occur. At the hearing on the petition, the rules of evidence do apply, and the state has the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. Second, the statute, 419B185, sets out specifically the determinations that the court has to make. And so in the context of the statute, in other words, this provision is not a standalone. It's a subsection of the broader statute. And this section where it says relevant to the determinations a court has to make, the other subsections of the statute set out what those determinations are. Third, the court still, although the rules of evidence don't apply except for those relating to privilege and relevance, the court still can determine, and the courts in this state do now, determine what weight to give to the evidence that is presented. And so what we're really talking about here is the form of the evidence and what the foundation is to get that evidence in. The court still, as I said, still can determine what weight to give it, and the court also retains the authority to determine whether the witnesses are credible. In other words, if the person comes in and says, I heard the parent saying this or that, that evidence can come in because it's not excluded by hearsay, but the court can still determine whether to believe that that's exactly what that witness heard, and if that witness's conclusion based on what the witness heard is reasonable under the circumstances. The scope of these hearings is very narrow and related to the determinations under 419B185 and also the allegations of the jurisdictional petition that are filed at the same time. The allegations in this petition, for example, alleged jurisdiction based on an unexplained injury, which is a statutory ground for jurisdiction under the juvenile code.
Okay. Might just be helpful also for the committee that it references back to ORS 40150, which is the definition of relevant evidence, and the statute defines relevant evidence means evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would have been without the evidence, than it would be without the evidence. So there's the definition of relevant evidence, if that gives you any idea of what that means when it says they may receive testimony.
Chair Williams and Representative Krummel, if I could, one other point which I think is important. The shelter care hearing that we're talking about is not the only hearing on shelter care before the jurisdictional petition hearing. This hearing we're talking about is the one that's within 24 hours of custody. But if either the parents or the state want another shelter hearing, let's say the circumstances of, let's say it's a case where the boyfriend has abused the child, and at the first hearing the boyfriend and the mother are together and they plan to live together. 2 weeks later, the mother decides, well, maybe it's not a good idea to live with this boyfriend, and so she says he's gone. Then the court can re-examine the shelter hearing. I wanted to add that to my response to your question, because I think that's another thing to remember here is that this is not a one-time decision by the court. It's to decide. It's an ongoing decision whether the child continues to need shelter care pending the adjudication of the petition.
Mr. Livingston, did you participate at all in the juvenile work group efforts that went on by the Law Commission?
I'm an appointed member of that work group.
I'm just wondering how this, because I wasn't on that work group, and we passed some of that legislation through, but there was some effort in those discussions to try to figure out which approach we were going to take in some of these proceedings, what level of evidence and some of those standards. Was this just an issue that didn't come up during sort of the course of those discussions, or just didn't fit within one of those law commission efforts?
Chair Williams, as I remember, there is another statute in the juvenile code, 419B325, which sets the standard for evidence in dispositions in these cases. It is a nightmare of language. It says that evidence can be admitted without regard to its competency or relevance. And I believe that's the statute that was the lightning rod for most of the discussion in that work group. And because there wasn't any real agreement on what that meant,
right,
then the work group didn't pursue it. As originally drafted, 115 referenced that statute. So I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that's the reason that it wasn't pursued there. Later on, after further review, was decided that not only because that language in 419B325 is ambiguous and sloppy, as one of the members of the Senate Judiciary pointed out, but also it really failed to capture what the current practice in the juvenile courts is. Mm-hmm. And based again on the discussions that we've had after the initial introduction of this, the current language in 115A and Gross does capture what the current practice is.
Okay, good. Are there any further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 115. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 115.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prasansky.
I move Senate Bill 115 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Prasansky moves Senate Bill 115 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I'm going to support the bill, but I do have concerns about and I understand Mr. Livingston's response, and I appreciate it very much, but I still have concerns about making sure that we don't go too far, and that parents end up being wrongly accused based on evidence at a shelter care hearing that may turn out to be erroneous. And so I think that, and there really is a balance that we need to make sure that we strike in protecting kids from people that would hurt them at the same time. So I recognize that, and I'll support it, but I just have reservations.
Thank you, Representative. I will note that the difference between the language in these two bills, if you look at the unamended version from the Senate, it does say it starts out the same. Received testimony, reports, and other material relating to the child's mental, physical, or social history and prognosis, and then it goes on to say, without regard to its competency or relevancy under the rules of evidence. Compared to the standard they've got now, I think they've gone a long way to address some of the very concerns you've underscored. So, I mean, I just point that out to you.
I would agree, Mr. Chair, that it definitely is a an improvement. And I, at the same time, I think that a physician's reports, hospital reports, those sorts of things that are found during a physical exam, there's really no reason not to allow those to be part of the court record and for the court to be able to take those into consideration. So,
okay. Anything else? All right. We'll call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Excused.
Crummell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Excused.
Blonsky?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Excused. Aye. Senate Bill 115A moves to the floor with a due pass. Anybody want this one? I'll take it. All right. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 117.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Jim Lampe is here. This bill would allow Department of Justice's client trust account to receive monies other than civil enforcement action monies, which would include criminal and seizure monies.
Okay, Mr. Lampe, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Williams and members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Jim Lamke. I'm the Fiscal Services Manager for the Department of Justice, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 117. ORS 180.200 authorizes the client trust account in the Department of Justice. This account acts as a holding account as money is received and then gets distributed to multiple recipients. It stays in this holding account. The current terminology in the statute restricts the use of this account to only civil cases. The purpose of Senate Bill 117 would expand that to also include criminal cases where money is received. Doesn't happen often, but we had a case several months ago where an investigator seized about $15,000 in cash, needed to deposit that money, didn't want to leave it in the evidence locker overnight, and because it was not authorized to be put into the client trust account, actually went down to the bank and opened up an account just to get the money secured until it could be properly distributed. So,
Mr. Lamke, that account wasn't in the name of Mr. Neely, was it?
Mm-hmm. No, sir.
Okay,
it was not.
Checking.
the benefits are that we save time and we save money for not having to pay for additional accounts at Treasury and the accounting processing. We maintain the accountability, separating it and keeping the interest earnings associated with the principal as it is deposited. And so it will be a benefit to us, and it will also give us some more flexibility. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Lamke? All right. Thank you, sir. Going to close. Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 117? Right. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I move SB 117 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 117 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? All right. Hearing none, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Excuse.
Jensen.
Aye.
Hummel.
Aye.
McPherson. Przanski.
Aye.
Generally.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 117 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to volunteer to carry it? Representative Anderson. All right. How was our time on that one, Mr. Neely? How much? 180 seconds.
180 seconds? Lose. Oh, we can do better than that, Mr. Chair.
Well, we had a little wager going on how long that bill would take. So. All right. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Eric Wassman is here from DOJ. This bill would amend the definition of robbery in the third degree in a case where a car is taken and carjacked, and the state might have a difficulty proving that it was taken for the intent to permanently deprive the driver of the car, where they then leave the car on the side of the road, and would allow for a prosecution without having to prove that element of permanently depriving, which you would have to prove for a theft, which is usually the basis of robbery. Mr. Wassman, I'm sure, will tell us about the Christine children in that case down in Southern Oregon.
Okay, Mr. Wassman, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Wassman. I'm the attorney in charge of the District Attorney Assistant Section, the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice. The purpose of Senate Bill 122 is to make clear that whenever a person uses force or threat of physical force to take property, including a vehicle, it should be robbery in every instance. The Christine case that counsel referred to occurred in Douglas County, and I've attached my written testimony. The testimony that was provided by the prosecutor in the Christine case before the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this year, describing the facts of the Christine case and how this difficulty in the statute came to his attention. But cutting short on that, let me describe essentially what occurred. Ruth and Brian Christine or Brian Christine at gunpoint approached a van, state van, that was being operated by child protective workers of the state of Oregon who had the Christine children in custody. The Christines took their children and the state van, drove it a short distance, approximately 3 miles away, abandoned the van, and then took the children with them and left the state of Oregon. There were numerous charges leveled against the Christines, but the robbery charge caused considerable litigation in that it became apparent that the way our robbery and theft statutes are currently drafted, it is not readily apparent that when you take a vehicle at the point of a gun, that in every instance you're committing the crime of robbery. If the vehicle is abandoned soon, or if the victim simply drives away at the point of a gun and takes their chance, the state may not be able to prove intent to deprive the person of the vehicle for a lengthy or permanent period of time. And that would be part of the requirement of theft, which is the predicate crime for robbery. So this bill would add to robbery the predicate crime of unauthorized use of a vehicle, which does not require intent to deprive people permanently of their vehicles. The two situations, as I described, where it can be somewhat challenging to prove that carjacking is in fact robbery would be the instance where the, as I described in the Christine case, the perpetrator abandons the vehicle soon after taking it, or another case where the defendant is simply unsuccessful in getting custody of the vehicle. It's my belief and our belief that in every instance, carjacking ought to be the crime of robbery, and that we've identified what we, I guess, would term a hole in the statutory scheme.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wassman. Are there questions for Representative Brzozinski?
Thank you. Eric, what I see here, it sounds fine. I'm just wondering, is there another hole that we're not plugging in the sense of if anyone takes any of the property by force and they abandon that property, let's say in a it's a shoplift with force, takes it up to a robbery, and then they drop the property on the way out. Is that still an issue for us to be maybe considering in the future?
Chair Williams, Representative Brzozinski, I think as a factual matter, it really is not, and that is because vehicles are different. When you take a vehicle and then abandon it, it's usually found later. It can be identified by the license plate and then returned to its owner, perhaps in a damaged condition, in which case you can perhaps prove enough for theft. But the property you describe where it's taken at the point of a gun and then abandoned, it's in most cases very unlikely that we're ever going to be able to trace that property back to its actual owner. So I think we're going to be able to show in those cases that there was an intent to deprive the owner of the property permanently or for such an extended period of time they lose the benefit of its economic value. So I think we really don't have a hole there in practical terms.
Thank you.
Any other questions? For those of you who are interested in what a vehicle is under ORS 164-135, it says the person takes, operates, exercises control over, rides in, or otherwise uses another's vehicle, boat, or aircraft without consent of the owner.
Vehicle includes bicycle.
I think that's for the vehicle code.
Yeah.
I don't know if it does for 164-135. Vehicle
doesn't define it.
Boat or aircraft is what it says.
Yeah, Mr. Okay. Chairman and Representative Brzozinski, the vehicle code is the one that has the broader description of vehicle.
So it isn't referenced.
So I don't think we're hitting the skateboards and bicycles the way this is defined within the statute.
It's amendment.
Yeah. Boy, I think we've got an amendment coming. I can feel
farm tractor.
Farm implement.
I assume that a canoe would be a boat. I mean.
So,
what do you mean you'd assume? It's only my canoe that's hanging in my garage since I'm here instead of in the water.
Chair Williams, if we actually had a canoe jacking, I think we'd probably have a robbery because
it's real property.
Possible we wouldn't recover the canoe. Or
all right,
if we did, be abandoned. a consumer.
Probably easier to catch.
An isolated place.
No, knowing this place would create a whole new statutory scheme for canoe jacking. That's what would do.
I cross a dead suspect depending on whose canoe.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Wassman. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 122? All right. Then we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prezzonsi.
Move Senate Bill 122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Prezzonsi has moved Senate Bill 122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right. Call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Arthur.
Aye.
Denza.
Aye.
Trumbull.
Aye.
Brisbane.
Aye.
Zvonsky.
Aye.
Chatterley.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. Senate Bill 122 moves to the floor with a two pass. Volunteers on this one? I'm going to look at this end of the table.
We got Barker over here.
Take it. Oh, do you want it? All right. Representative Barker.
Y'all get the rest of the bills.
Yeah. Someone on this side has to take the last one here, so we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 123.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 123 would allow a judge to impanel additional alternate members of a jury on a misdemeanor jury panel. Misdemeanors have a six-member jury panel. There are cases where a misdemeanor trial can go on for some time, and this would allow for alternates in the case that one of the jurors could not continue throughout the trial.
Saving the best for last, Mr. Fusner.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Fusner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Department of Justice. Under current law, alternate jurors can be impaneled only in felony cases, not in misdemeanor trials. So if a juror becomes ill or dies or can't continue for some other reason during a misdemeanor trial, the only alternative is for the court to declare a mistrial, start over with, at a later date with a completely new jury. That's expensive. It's particularly a problem in cases in which you have, for example, expert witnesses, witnesses who've come from out of state, child victim witnesses that you don't want to have to put through the trial all over again. And what Senate Bill 123 does is very simply permit a trial court to impanel alternate jurors in misdemeanor trials. It does not require appointing them, and I would imagine that it would be limited pretty much to situations where it's the kind of trial you really don't want to have to retry. And it will save the expense of retrying cases unnecessarily. I might mention that, as far as I know, there is no opposition to this bill, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association supported this bill when we had our hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Susan is nodding in agreement back behind you, so we'll put that on the record. Who's responsible for making the determination for the appointment of the alternate jurors? Of the bill. It says the court may. I mean, is this going to be a judge-by-judge determination as to whether to pull more jurors up from the juror pool to appoint as alternates, or is this something that the parties are going to make a motion for? How does that work?
Well, the statute pretty plainly, as it reads now, and this would not change, says that the court may, in its discretion, direct impaneling of alternate jurors. My experience has been that generally the parties ask the court to do that in felony trials. I don't think I've ever encountered a judge who refused to impanel alternates in a felony trial if either party asked the court to do it, but I suppose that's a possibility.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Fusner?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Just so I get a sort of further feel for this, how often do misdemeanor trials go on more than one day? I mean, it sounds like it's more complex presentation of evidence than I would have expected in a misdemeanor case.
Well, I've tried a few that went several days in misdemeanor cases. They can get fairly complicated. And even if it only lasts a day, it's always a possibility that we'll have a juror who becomes sick, or sometimes they go out to lunch and they don't come back for reasons we never find out what happened, but you know, Mrs. Jones just isn't there for the afternoon session.
Steps off the curb and here comes that bus.
Yeah.
Anyone who's served jury duty in Multnomah County, as I have, Mr. Chair, would probably sympathize with
that. All right. Anything else for Mr. Fussner? Thank you. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 123? Susan, you want to come up?
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just briefly, we're in strong support of this bill. While it is generally true that misdemeanor trials are short, sometimes they're not, as has been previously represented, sometimes a lunch hour can be too long in terms of a witness's attendance. The most predictable thing about trials is their unpredictability, and that includes jurors. And so we feel that this is, there's a lot of effort that goes into these trials, misdemeanor or felonies, and to have a trial sabotaged by a juror who doesn't return. And sometimes it's not even the juror's fault. I mean, it's not a conscious thing. Jurors get ill. Sometimes, and these are the kind of cases where I think it would happen, when they're talking about a trial that it goes several days or this is often usually the fatal timing problem when a trial goes over a weekend and things happen or people get ill, you know, children of jurors get ill. So it can either be sort of a conscious neglect on jurors or often it's an illness. And so this is a good bill and it's a gap that should be remedied by this bill.
Okay. Thanks, Susan. Ann, could you come up on this? I just had a quick question for you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dole was distracting me, Mr. Chair.
That's all right. We allow talking in class here, so that's okay. Any fiscal on this, or is it just assumed that this will just be extra people pulled out of the already existing juror pool, and therefore there won't be any additional cost?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ann Christian from the Oregon Judicial Department. And I'm looking at the Judicial Department's fiscal impact statement that was prepared on this, and the conclusion that was reached, in part due to the fact that jury trials in the scheme of total caseload is very rare, about 5% in misdemeanor cases and no more than 10% even in Measure 11 cases. The consensus in the fiscal impact statement is based upon the relative infrequency that this would not be entail a fiscal impact at all for the Judicial Department. That in part is due to the fact that I believe some judges, as Mr. Fussner testified, currently do allow additional alternate jurors to serve. And I'm recalling now, Mr. Chair, any adverse fiscal impact would, we believe, be offset by the adverse fiscal impact of having a mistrial. So if you have no alternate jurors and there's a mistrial, you start over.
Right. Okay. Good. Thank you. Anything else before we let Ann go? Okay. Anyone else here on 123? All right, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move Senate Bill 123 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 123 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? Okay, call the roll, Nancy.
Aye.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Hummel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 123 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson to carry the bill. And that is our agenda for the day. We are adjourned. Okay.